My name's Nicola Pitchford. I'm the Dean of the School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at Dominican, and I'm also a member of the board of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies. It's a special pleasure for me representing the School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences this evening to be asked to begin the introductions, as many of our faculty and students love Isabel Allende's work, have taught Isabel Allende's work. Some of us have had the pleasure of reading it in more than one language. It's so widely translated and translatable. And I'm just delighted, as myself, a professor of contemporary literature, to get to be part of the group welcoming Isabel Allende this evening. This lecture series is a program of the Institute for Leadership Studies, a center for leadership development, offering education and training for students and professionals to become better leaders. The Institute also hosts public events like this one to engage students, the campus, and our community in socially relevant discussions, and to highlight inspired acts of leadership across the disciplines. Isabel Allende has demonstrated leadership in so many ways. Here at Dominican, we call her Dr. Allende, since she received an honorary doctorate from Dominican some years ago, and that's one of her collection of honorary doctorates. This evening's live performance will also be aired on Dominican's website, a podcast on Dominican's Penguin Radio, and these lectures are aired on Wednesdays on Channel 30 Public TV. It's particularly important to thank our sponsors. Our lead sponsor for the lectureship series is Private Ocean, Personal Powerful Wealth Management. Named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide, Private Ocean is one of the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin. On behalf of Dominican University, I'd like to express our gratitude to Private Ocean for its generous support of the Leadership Lecture Series. Our additional sponsor for tonight's event is our silver sponsor, the Women's Leadership and Philanthropy Council, a women's organization. Thank you. Focused on educating women and girls and advancing them as leaders engaging in the community. They sponsor an ILS event twice a year, and we are very proud to have their support. Joining us now this evening to introduce our program and Ms. Allende is Richard Stone, founder and chairman of Private Ocean Wealth Management, the lead sponsor for this year's lecture series. Richard is also a member of Dominican University of California's Board of Trustees. Richard Stone has served as a leader in the wealth management business for more than 40 years. He has been awarded the prestigious Charles Schwab Impact Leadership Award for his lifetime contributions to the financial planning industry. And on behalf of the university, I'd like to express our gratitude again to Private Ocean and to Richard Stone for their generous support of the Leadership Lecture Series so that these lectures will be accessible to our whole community. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Stone.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome Isabel Allende back to the Leadership Lecture Series. Isabel won worldwide acclaim when her best-selling first novel, The House of Spirits, was published in 1982. The book, which tells the lives of two families living in Chile from the 1920s to the country's military coup in 1973, established her as a feminist force worldwide and shook Latin America's male-dominated literary world. Isabel's books include 20 novels, outstanding works of nonfictions, and series of children's books. Her books have sold over 57 million copies and are read, studied, and loved by readers of over 30 languages. She has received so many awards that I can't begin to list them, but they range from Hans Christian Andersen Award for her children's books to our own Book One, One Book, One Marin Award for Daughter of Fortune. Isabel devotes much of her time to human rights. Following the death of her daughter, Paula, in 1992, Isabel established a foundation dedicated to the protection and empowerment of women and children worldwide. This evening, we are celebrating Isabel Allende's newest novel, Maya's Notebook. We are in for a treat. The Book Passage Dominican Lecture Series is the first stop on Isabel's nationwide book tour. Ms. Allende will begin her lecture by telling us about Maya's Notebook and then reading a passage from the book. Book Passage President Elaine Petroncelli will then join Ms. Allende in conversation. Please join me in welcoming Isabel Allende.
Well, thank you for showing up. I'm always terrified that there will only be the bookseller and my family, which I think is the case, more or less. Well, thank you for coming. I know it was difficult to park and difficult to get out in such a beautiful day. I'm going to read briefly from Maya's notebook, but first let me tell you a little bit about the book. I've been writing historical novels for a while, and I was fed up with research and studying and getting everything right. It was just very boring. So I wanted to write something that wouldn't require so much work, and I decided to write something that would be contemporary, and I could get the inspiration from something that I know. And at the time, I wrote this book in 2010, all my grandchildren were teenagers, and I was surrounded by these crazy people. And hearing their voices, watching them going through all the things that teenagers go through, and the horror of the parents that can't protect them from all the dangers they're exposed to, and how reckless they all are, I wanted to write something that would sort of exorcise the demon of teenage years. And so I created a character that is like a summary of all of them. And this character is Maya, doesn't look like any of my grandchildren. Very fortunate for us, none of my grandchildren went through hell as Maya does. Maya is brought up by her grandparents, her Chilean grandmother, who is very much like me, the kind of tough grandmother that will slap her around, but she loves her. And a grandfather, an African-American astronomer that she adores. And when he dies and the grandmother goes into a depression, the girl she loses her center. And she ends up with the wrong friends, shoplifting, drugs, alcohol, stupid little things, until those things get worse and worse. And finally she runs away from home and ends up in Las Vegas and hooks up with a gang of drug dealers. And she gets involved in a federal crime. At that point, when she's ill, homeless, addicted, dying really, her grandmother finally finds her, intervenes, and sends her to a remote island in the southern part of Chile, Chiloé, where this girl will have to be disconnected from the social media because she's hiding from the FBI, the CIA, the police, the gangsters, the assassins, everybody. So it was fun to create a book that had the structure of a crime novel with suspense. Are they going to find her? Are they not going to find her? Whatever. So it was fun to compete with my husband, who writes crime novels, not as good as my books. I keep telling him. So I'm going to read now a piece that is when she's in Las Vegas, where she goes through all these things that I've been telling you, and this is at the very end of the ordeal. The same day of my encounter with Officer Arana, a couple of hours later, Joe Martin and Chino finally caught up with me. I didn't see the frightful black van, and I didn't sense the thugs approaching until they were right on top of me because I'd spent the $10 Arana gave me on drugs and I was high. They forced me into the vehicle while I screamed and kicked in desperation. Some people stopped, but no one interceded. Who's going to mess with two dangerous-looking guys and a hysterical homeless girl? I tried to jump out of the van while it was still moving, but John Martin paralyzed me with a punch in the neck. They took me back to the building I knew all too well, Brandon Lehman's den of drug addicts and criminals. The rude things down on the wall, the garbage and broken glass had multiplied, and it smelled of excrement. They dragged me up to the apartment on the third floor. "Now you are going to sing, you slut," Joe Martin threatened me, an inch from my face, squeezing my breast with his ape-like hands. "You are going to tell us where Lehman hid the money, or I'll break every bone in your body one at a time." At that instant, Chino's cell phone rang. He talked for a couple of seconds and then told Joe Martin that they had orders to get going. They were waiting for them. They gagged me with a rag in my mouth and adhesive tape, threw me down on one of the mattresses, tied my ankles together and my wrists with electric cord, and then tied them to each other so I was bent backwards. They left after warning me again that what would they do to me when they got back. And I was left alone, unable to scream or move, the cord cutting into my ankles and wrists, my neck sore where they'd hit me, suffocating from the rag in my mouth, terrified at what was going to happen to me at the hands of those murderers, and because the effect of the alcohol and drugs was beginning to wear off. I tried not to vomit, though I was gagging and could feel it coming up my throat. I thought I would die of asphyxiation. How long was I on that mattress? It's impossible to know with any certainty, but it felt to me like several days, although it should have been less than an hour. Very soon I began to tremble violently and to bite the rag, now soaked with saliva. With every shudder, the wire dug deeper into my skin. The fear and the pain kept me from thinking. I was running out of air, and I started to pray for Joe Martin and Chino to return so I could tell them everything. Everything I knew, take them to Beatty to see if they could shoot those locks off, and if they then shot me in the head, that would at least be preferable to being tortured to death like an animal. I didn't care about the damn money. Now, months later, in this little island of Chiloé, with the calm of distance, I understand that was their way of making me confess. They didn't have to break my bones. The torment of withdrawal was enough. Outside, the sun had set, no light filter in between the boards over the windows, and inside the darkness was total. Meanwhile, I, sicker and sicker, kept praying the murderers would come back. But it wasn't Joe Martin or Chino who turned on the light and leaned over me. It was Freddie, my little friend, so skinny and demented that for a moment I didn't recognize him. "Shit, girl, fuck, fuck," he was mumbling as he tried to get the gag off my mouth with a trembling hand. He finally got the rag out, and I could take an immense breath and fill my lungs up with air, retching and coughing. "Freddie, Freddie, sweet Freddie." He couldn't get me untied. He only had one hand and was missing two fingers of the other one. He never recovered the use of it entirely after that beating. He went to get a knife from the kitchen and started fighting with the electric cord until he managed to cut it, and after eternal minutes, free me. My ankles and wrists were bleeding, but I didn't notice until later. In those moments, I was overcome by the anguish of withdrawal. Finding my next hit was the only thing that mattered to me. It was useless to try to stand up as I was shaking by convulsive spasms, with no control over my extremities. "You have to get out of here," the boy was repeating like a litany. Freddie went to the kitchen again and came back with a pipe, a blowtorch, and a handful of crack. He lit it and put it in my mouth. I inhaled deeply, and that gave me back a bit of strength. "How are we going to get out of here, Freddie?" I murmured. My teeth were chattering. "Walking is the only way. Stand up, girl," he answered. And we walked out in the simplest way through the front door. We slipped down the stairs in the darkness, glued to the wall, him holding me up by the waist, me leaning on his shoulders. He was so small, but his brave heart more than made up for his fragility. We walked a few blocks in the shadow of the houses, getting away from the building. Freddie tried to stop several taxis, but when they saw us, they speeded up. We must have been a deplorable spectacle. He took me to the bus stop, and we got on the first one that came without noticing where it was going or paying any attention to the expressions of repugnance and the faces of the passengers or the driver's glances in the rearview mirror. I was disheveled, smelled of piss, had smears of blood on my arms and shoes. We got out at the last stop, where Freddie took me to a public washroom, and I cleaned myself up as best as I could, which wasn't much. And then we got on another bus, and then another, and we went around and around Las Vegas for hours to shake the thugs off. At last, Freddie took me to a black neighborhood where I'd never been. The badly lit streets were empty at this time of the night, lined with humble working class houses, porches with wicker chairs, yards full of junk and old cars. After that terrible beating that Freddie had taken for going into a neighborhood he didn't belong in, it took a lot of courage to take me there. But he didn't seem worried, as if he'd walked down those streets many times. We arrived at a house no different from all the rest, and Freddie rang the bell several times insistently. Finally, we heard a thundering voice. "Who's got the nerve to bother us so late?" The porch light came on, the door opened, opened a few inches, and an eye inspected us. "Praise the Lord, is that you, Freddie?" It was Olympia Pettiford in a plush pink bathrobe, the nurse who had taken care of Freddie in the hospital when he got beaten up, the gentle giant, the Madonna of the defenseless, the splendid woman who ran her own church of the widows for Jesus. Olympia opened her door wide and hugged me in her African goddess's embrace. "Poor girl, poor little girl." She carried me to the sofa of her living room and lay me down there with the tenderness of a mother with a newborn baby. Thank you.
Now you see why I'm so crazy about this book.
Isabel, Maya's notebook, I've had the joy of reading all your books. I met you because of one of your books, The Stories of Ava Luna. I feel that one of the greatest privileges of my job is that I have your friendship.
Thank you.
But I was pretty surprised about Maya's notebook. It's a real departure from every book you write is different, so I probably think this every time, forgive me, but this is a 19-year-old girl. You don't
And it's very contemporary. It happens right now.
Yes, it's not history. It's
yeah. Although the translation took so long that now it looks like a historical novel. Yeah.
Well, we're all going to learn Spanish, so that doesn't happen to us. We don't have to wait again. But how did you decide to write the story of a 19-year-old?
I told you because I was surrounded by teenagers, and worried sick for each one of them. You know that in the streets there was drugs, alcohol, crime, violence. In the internet porn, any pervert could approach them. I had a granddaughter who had the boyfriend from hell. Thank God we got rid of that guy. I hope he's not in the audience. And so we were worried sick for the kids. My son lost all his hair. He looks 10 years older than he should because of the kids. And we couldn't protect them, the feeling that everything is out there and you have given them some love and structure and they will have to fend for themselves. It's a matter of luck. Some may make it and some don't.
But Maya is a child who has a wonderful upbringing, as do all of our Marin children.
Yeah, sure.
With a loving grandmother and a fabulous grandfather who teaches her about the stars, and yet when things fall apart at home.
Because she's at a very vulnerable age. She's 16. She has no parents to speak of. The father is an airline pilot, a womanizer who is always in the air or in somebody's bed. The mother is a Danish woman whom she doesn't know because she left her when she was a baby. And so she adores her grandfather and fears her grandmother. And the grandfather dies. When she's 16, the grandmother goes into a depression and the girl feels abandoned. And she gets in touch with the wrong friends. A couple of girls who are called the vampires in the school. They are that bad. And they start doing all kinds of crazy stuff without thinking of the consequences. Of course, they never do.
Never. The grandmother is a wonderful character.
It's me. It's me. I didn't have to invent her.
She's smart. She's tough.
Yeah, she's
she
great.
She will do anything for her child.
She has long legs. She's great.
Brilliant. And I don't know who will play her in the film, but it better be somebody really good looking. But
Penelope Cruz, I hope.
I hope so. Some of us were raised in families where the old-fashioned 1950s nuclear family, the mother, the father, the children. You seem to have a more interesting view of what a family is.
You know, when I came to the United States 25 years ago, I landed in Willis, in the guy I was in lust with, family. And it wasn't a family to speak of. It was completely dysfunctional. And I needed my extended family, so I started putting together, bringing people in to put together a family, because I think that it's good for kids and good for people in general to be with other generations, to be in something more than the nuclear family. You know, kids are suffocated by these nuclear families, and then as soon as they can, they leave, and they try never to come back, only for Thanksgiving. In an extended family, there's space to breathe, you know, and you become more tolerant with problems of age. You know, I promise that I had not heard ever the word, the difficult twos, that at 2 years old, kids are sort of crazy, or that teenagers were supposed to be impossible. Because it's just another stage of growing up, and you are with your grandfather who is demented, and you are with your mother who is in menopause, and that's part of life. I mean, why everything has to be compartmented and separated, and each one needs a special therapist? Sorry, Larry. Everybody needs a therapist to treat this problem that is growing up, living in life, having pain, having joy, the things that happen to all of us.
It's true. But you see, in Marin, we have a lot of therapists, and it's really good for business because they buy a lot of books. But
according to my husband, all the guys that you see there in Starbucks and Pete's at 11 o'clock in the morning, they're all therapists.
We actually had a couple of people doing therapy in our cafe for a while, but they never bought any coffee, so we kind of became uncomfortable. But you write beautifully about addiction, and I know that this is a very tender subject, but is addiction really something that can be cured? Maya has something wonderful happen, but...
Yeah, Maya is lucky. She is in the streets doing drugs only for a few months. And she's very young, and so she's sort of redeemed at some point. But she knows, because at the end of the book, she falls in love. And something happens in that love affair, and she realizes that she's addicted to the boyfriend as she was addicted to drugs. And she realizes that it's something that she will have to deal with for the rest of her life. And you're never cured. You have to be alert, because the demon of addiction is lurking always. I have seen all the stages in our family, in Willie's children. And he has 3 biological children, and 2 are already dead for drug-related causes. One of them died 3 or 4 weeks ago. So it's been a very hard road. And we were sure that the young one that just died was in recovery, that he hadn't used for years, and we were fooled, because when we found out that he had died of an overdose, and we went into the apartment. There were enough needles there to show that he had been using for maybe years. So I don't know. People ask me, what can parents do? I wish I knew, because we tried everything and nothing worked.
You did. One of the things you tried was a special school in Oregon. And I've heard other families in my life tell me that they sent their children to these special schools that are going to reprogram the child or something.
Yeah, they cost an absolute fortune. And the kids complain that it is horrible. When we visited, it didn't look so horrible. It looked pretty good, actually. And I think the school kept this kid safe for 3 years. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he got out, he was doing drugs again. So I don't know what good did it do. Well, at least it kept him safe. Yeah.
So the school that is in the book...
is the same school. I didn't have to invent it. It's the same school in Oregon. And things that happened to Maya, I lived them with my stepchildren. I saw them. So there's a scene in the book that... I have to go back to tell you that when I wrote The Sum of Our Days, it's about my family, it's about the tribe, this little extended family that we put together. And of course, he was in the book. But when I finished the manuscript and it was translated into English, I gave everybody the manuscript to see if they objected to anything. And he didn't want to be in the book because he was depicted like an addict, although by then he was in recovery. And so I got really angry. We had a fight, and then I had to rewrite the book and take him out. 50 pages went to the garbage. I should have kept them. You should never throw away anything. You can always recycle literature, always. But I threw it away because I was so mad. And then when I wrote Maya's notebook, I remember things he had told me. And one of the things he told me, which is exactly in the book, he told me that he almost overdosed in a public bathroom. And he was dying in a public bathroom. And the door had a part, like, you know, the door doesn't go all the way down to the floor. And he was lying on the floor. And he was letting himself go into this darkness that was so soothing and so peaceful. And he heard the voice of his sister, who was already dead, saying, "Breathe, breathe," and forcing him to breathe. And he saw her shoes under the door. And he started breathing. And when he told me the story, you can say this was an hallucination, this was, he was so out of it that he saw things that were not there, whatever. But the memory of his sister saved him. So I have in the book the same scene in which Maya is dying in a public bathroom also, exactly the same situation. And her dead grandfather comes and says, "Breathe, Maya, breathe." And she sees his English shoes, and she starts breathing. So I didn't have to make up anything. Life is so tragic, you know. It has so many elements of the unknown. Everything is so mysterious. Was Jennifer there for Harley? Was Popo for Maya? I don't know.
In some way
they were.
Definitely. This book, one of the reasons I think it's so magnificent is it deals with really hard issues. The characters are fabulous. There's a terrific love story. There's love lots of different ways. But it's also a mystery.
Yeah, it has the structure of with suspense. Like a mystery. Not exactly the perfect formula, but somehow it is a mystery. But you know, what I liked when I was writing the book, because sometimes I have an idea of how I want the book, and it doesn't turn out that way. The characters start doing things, and things happen that are a surprise for me too. So in this book, I found new characters walking into the story with their own tragedies and their own lives that enrich the story. For example, when the girl goes to Chiloé, I had been in Chiloé. I had researched it. So I knew exactly what island she would end up in. But I didn't have the characters of the island at all. And then I get her there, and these people start to appear. This man, mysterious man that lives in a house with no doors, that has nightmares, that has a past that she needs to uncover, a woman who loves him and doesn't dare tell him, the community of people who live in the island and adopt Maya, all those people, they're gifts from heaven, you know? They just walk into the story.
And they're wonderful. I love the witches.
Oh, the witches, yeah.
They were a fabulous contrast to the girls in Berkeley High. You had the girls at Berkeley High who, with the peer pressure, led her down the path she took. And then you had the witches.
Yeah, I had been in Chiloé many times. It's an archipelago of many islands. And this time I needed to find the perfect island. And so Willie, my son Nicolas, and my daughter-in-law Lori and I went to Chiloé with a very good guide that told us about the mythology, showed us the place. We navigated the channels to find the island, and we decided where we would place the story. It's not mentioned, the name of the island, but we know exactly what it is. And I described it. And this guide told us about this circle of witches that gather on full moon. And if Lori and I wanted to participate, of course we said immediately.
Definitely.
So Lori and I ended up, and these benevolent witches were young, beautiful young women, mothers, but they were in general very young. And they meet on the full moon in the house of one of them that has a yard in the back. And the yard has a kiva, it's a hole, a big hole, and then a dome. And then you have to crawl into the Pachamama. Pachamama is Mother Earth. So you go back to the womb of Mother Earth, and there all these women, they had taken their clothes off, some left some underwear or whatever, and they were sitting in a circle, and there was a fire in the middle. And they started telling their lives and sharing their sorrows, and they sang, and then finally they voted to accept Lori and I in the circle of witches, and we got there unanimously. So it was beautiful. We are still in touch with them.
And so now I have a friend who is a witch. This is very exciting.
A legal witch.
Yeah. Now I know.
So
what
I have a spiritual circle, mm-hmm. here. We call ourselves the Sisters of Perpetual Disorder, and but we are crones, you know. Mm. We wouldn't dare take our clothes off and drink tea naked. I don't think we would.
Yeah. But as I read about the witches, I thought about your group because of the power of a group of women.
My group is wonderful. It keeps me connected to, for example, now today is the first day of my book tour. And for a month, I will be going with Lori around the country. And I'm always connected. There's a line that connects me to reality. And that mm-hmm. is my prayer group. We don't pray. Yeah? We smoke pot. We do that. We don't pray.
This is my kind of prayer group. I understand your next book is going to be a thriller. How did you learn about thriller
My husband is writing crime novels. He's now writing his sixth crime novel. And he's having some success. He's being translated to several languages. Tomorrow he's leaving for Brazil to a book fair. And I had decided to retire because I'm tired. I decided to retire and my agent panicked because I support the agency. Me alone. So she said, no, you have to write a book with Willie. The only thing that Willie can write is crime novels in the 60s. That's the only thing he can write. So I had to accommodate. I thought, okay, we will write a crime novel together. Mm-hmm. That lasted 2 hours. And then we got in a horrible fight because he writes in English, I write in Spanish. He doesn't research, he invents everything. I research like crazy. And his attention span is 11 minutes. My is 11 hours. So we would never be able to work together. But it was January 8th, and I didn't have any other thing to write. So I decided that I would continue with the idea of the crime novel, and it turned out to be more and more complicated, and it became like a sort of thriller. And then I went to the mystery conference in Book Passage.
Oh, I was hoping she'd say that.
I did. And I learned a lot, and I heard people talk about the process and about how to plant the clues and the red herrings and this and that. And I met Dr. Lyle.
Dr.
Lyle is a guy who is an expert in everything that has to do with rotten bodies, with bleeding wounds, with poison, with weapons, with his, all the forensic stuff. And so he helped me a lot.
He's amazing.
Yeah, and for a year I was researching in the internet and buying books about all kinds of awful stuff, awful stuff. So I'm sure that the FBI will show up at my door any minute.
No doubt.
Yeah.
They'll be after you. Well, I can't wait to read that one. But in this one, too, there is a feeling that it's everything. And there is maybe not. Yeah, the thriller in Las Vegas, my heart was beating really, really fast when everyone was after Maya, the FBI, the crooked cop, the drug dealer. Did you spend a lot of time in Las Vegas checking it out?
Just enough to take a look. It's not my favorite place on earth.
Probably not. I can't imagine. I'd like to talk a little bit about Manuel, the man in Chile. He's a wonderful character.
Nini, the grandmother, rescues the girl from the house of Olympia Pettiford, who called this nurse calls the grandmother, and the grandmother comes to pick up the granddaughter, who is a mess, and sends her to Chiloé, sends her to the house of a friend that she hasn't seen in 35 years. And one wonders as a reader, and Maya wonders also, why would this guy receive a conflicted teenager in his house? He's the kind of hermit that doesn't want to talk to anybody, and he has to receive this crazy kid. Why? And so then we start to uncover all what has happened in his past, which allowed me to tell the story, the political story of Chile. So mm-hmm. that also gets included in the book.
He's absolutely marvelous. And that really snuck up on me, that I was going to learn more about Chile and the dictatorship.
Yeah, because when Maya gets there, she has no idea of the history of the country, and she's not interested. And nobody talks about it. But then she starts uncovering stuff.
Well, that's part of the genius of this book, is that as Maya learns things, we are seeing it through Maya's eyes. I was never felt that I was away from her. She was part of it.
Because she's writing in first person. That's the good thing about writing in first person.
But there's challenges to writing in first
person. Yeah, of course, it's very limited.
You have to be a really good writer to write in first person.
I am.
Well,
maybe I'm not a great writer, but I have 30 years of experience, and that means something.
And I'm not the only one who thinks that. I love on your website watching you receive the Hans Christian Andersen Award from the Prince of Denmark.
Oh, he's so cute.
Oh, he was so handsome. And the only other writer who's ever received that award is J.K. Rowling.
Can you imagine? I'm in very good company.
If anyone here has missed Isabel's marvelous children's books, I think that may have been, it says the Hans Christian Andersen Literary Award.
For children's books, yeah.
But I think they're talking about children's books because they talk about your magical way of drawing in the reader and captivating people. But you've just learned that you're going to have another award, which I'm really proud about.
Also, I'm in very good company with that award.
Yes, this is going to be in Chicago, and the company includes Salman Rushdie, who was here last fall, And David McCullough, who was here as
Toni
part of
Morrison.
The service. Toni Morrison, who has been here at Dominican, one of our lectures. And it is the Carl Sandburg Award. And this is a huge award. So I am so happy to see that happening, because I know that it's really nice to receive the awards, but that I am sitting here with a question. Somebody says, how do you write so many books? And I know the answer to that, which is that you work really, really, really hard.
I don't have anything else to do. I mean, I'm 70 years old. I don't have a lover. I don't have any particular vice. I don't do any sports. What else can I do?
But this question asks, as often comes up, how do you do it? I mean, how do you concentrate? A lot of people would like to write a novel, but somehow life gets in the way. And I've noticed you don't let anything get in the way.
No, it's not a hobby. I started my books on January 8th. I lock myself in a room and I don't go out. And I have a team of wonderful women that protect me from the world. Juliet, Lori, Sarah, and I have to mention my son Nico and Willie, who are not ladies, but they also help me a lot. And they keep me protected. So I can really, really work. And I love it. It's not work for me. It's just joyful.
Well, I've noticed that you're happiest when you're writing.
Yeah. I'm not happy when I'm traveling, but I'm happy when I'm writing.
But even when you're traveling, I've seen you sitting there starting to think about the new book. I mean, I don't think it ever stops. Someone has asked a question, and it is in Spanish. And so I don't think I can read that. Would you like to borrow my glasses?
Isabel, me gustaría saber de dónde te surgen las ideas para escribir una nueva obra literaria. Mi nombre es Alejandra. Okay, Alejandra wants to know, where do I get my ideas to write a book? It depends. Sometimes the ideas just fall on my lap. Other times I think I'm looking for something over here and something comes in between and it's much better. And so I focus on that. That happened with Island Beneath the Sea. I wanted to write a book about the pirates of the Caribbean, and I started researching New Orleans, and then I realized that all the French flavor of that city comes from 10,000 French refugees in 1800. Why these people came to New Orleans? Because they were running away from the slave revolt in Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti. And I started researching that to learn about the 10,000 refugees, and that story was much better. So I ended up writing about Haiti. So you never know what will bring the story in, but I need to be connected at a belly. It has to be a belly connection with the story. People give me wonderful stories to write, and I can't write them because I have not experienced them, or it's not something that I am passionate about, obsessed with. Mm-hmm. When I finished Island Beneath the Sea, which is a story of slavery, I thought, why did I write this that has nothing to do with my background? There were no African slaves in Chile, no plantations. It has nothing to do with anything that I know. Why would I write about that? And when the book was finished, I realized that I was writing about absolute power. And power is something that has obsessed me always. Absolute power and the abuse of power. It could be the military, it could be the government, it could be an abusive father in a family, it could be, in this case, the worst kind of abuse, the master and the slave. So that was the theme that I got hooked with.
I know that you sometimes, when you are researching a book, though, you find somebody who knows something about what you need to know. I don't know how you do it.
Well,
but you find the most obscure people.
Well, if it's a historical novel, it's very hard to find someone who has experienced it. They're dead, all dead. But sometimes you can find letters that they wrote in the moment. And those letters are usually much better than all the history books, because it's daily life, it's the point of view of people, common people. It's not the historian that recreates the events. And always from a male perspective, white male perspective. So the letters are usually fascinating. And for this book, for Maya, it was very easy because everybody was around. And for the new book, Ripper, this crime novel, I wish I could have found the assassin, but I had to invent the assassin.
The assassins won't talk to you?
No, they won't talk to me, but I did find a Navy SEAL, thanks to Sarah, and I found many people, wonderful people.
And what is it about you that people will tell you things that they're not allowed to tell anyone?
No, people, if you ask a person to tell their stories, everybody will talk to you. we are dying to tell our story. Everybody is. Get in an elevator and say, for example, I'm going to tell you a story. Nobody gets out of the elevator. And you start traveling back and down, and nobody gets out. People are fascinated by stories. And if they can tell their own stories, it's even better.
That's amazing. The next question is about your foundation. And I know this person mentions that you have done so much for women and girls all over the country, all over the world. But she wants to know, how did this come about, and what are some of the projects that really interest you?
Getting my website. If you Google my name, the first thing that comes out is the foundation, and there is a very good website done by wonderful people, my family. And it's very clear the kind of programs that we support, and it's programs that help women and girls or children in the areas of education, health, protection, that health includes contraception, of course. And we do work in different countries in the world, always among the people who are really in need, the poorest of the poor. And it has been a wonderful, wonderful thing for me. It started as an homage to my daughter. When my daughter died, I wrote a book called Paula, and the book did very well, and I didn't want to touch any of the money that came from that book, so I put it in a separate account until I could come up with an idea that would honor Paula. And something happened to me that made me realize that what Paula would want and I would want is to help women and girls.
And through that, you met Eve Ensler, as she supported her foundation.
We were here. We were here recently.
Well, she came here because of you, and now she's coming.
No, I came because of her. You're wrong.
Whichever way. Yeah. We wouldn't have known her to ask. I would have been afraid to ask her because I wouldn't have known how, but now she's coming next month again.
Yeah.
And we thank you for that. It's very exciting. You talked about the fact that there is things that are true and based on truth, and then there are things that are fiction. And this question's a little bit difficult, but I think you can answer it, is, are you aware when you are writing fiction and when you are writing fact? Do they get blended in your mind?
I have no idea what is fact in my life. And what is, no, really. I think of my past. How much is memory? And how much I have made up? Because the process in the brain of memory and imagination are very similar. And I don't think that we remember anything exactly as it happened. And if two people witness the same event, they will remember it differently. So it's very personal, very subjective. And in my own life, I don't know what's true and what isn't. I make up people, I make up situations, things. I've always said that I tend to do this with the men I fall in love with. Let's say the men I fall in lust with. They are like Christmas trees with no ornaments. And I hang the ornaments, a lot of them. And then usually the ornaments stay in the tree a long time, around 25 years. And then they start to fall one by one. And by then the tree is almost dead. So I find myself stuck with a guy who has no ornaments at all and looks like a dead pine. So I have to think, I say to myself, well, how much do I invent? When I write a memoir and I describe the people in my family, are they real or I see them that way? I don't know. Maybe I just see them that way.
And yet, when you write fiction, such as The Infinite Plan...
That's the story of Willie when I was in love with Willie.
I think if Willie were here, he would object to me.
Actually, I still love him.
I know you adore that man.
No, I mean, all the ornaments have fallen, but I still love him. And also, at 70, you don't have a choice, Elaine. Yeah. Let's be realistic.
Oh, well, he's a pretty cool guy. Isabel, you are so giving and have brought so many wonderful hours to all of our lives.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this time tonight. We'll be listening and watching. We heard you this morning on Michael Krasny's show. It was wonderful. I do have one more question, though. How about Placido Domingo? Are his ornaments still good? I know that he...
Well, I don't know him that well. I have never seen him in a bathrobe.
Oh.
So I don't know.
I am Isabel's friend, and I'm not jealous of her. But one day I answered the phone at the store because she was having tea, and the voice on the other end said he was Placido Domingo and could he talk to Miss Allende. And that day I got really jealous. I thought that was...
Yeah, that was my son. That was Nicolas. Yeah,
it was my son. Was he making it up?
Yeah, of course.
I was still jealous. But thank you for all the wonderful hours and days of beautiful literature and all you do for this community.
Thank you.
And women and children, which... benefits the men, too, of the world.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I will be signing books here.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you.